The transmit button was a long rectangle, very similar to the space key on a keyboard, except that it was red. Opsa's hand hovered 2 centimeters above it. The fate of the entire podcast was now tied to these slender, sexy fingers. Without hesitation, Opsa pressed the button. Fresh content would now stream to every patron member in the universe. Welcome to Science Fiction Book Club, a podcast for bookworms and stargazers. In every episode, we dive into the pages of our favorite science fiction novels to break down the big ideas, ask the nerdy questions, and just maybe learn a bit about ourselves along the way. My name's Abu, and as always, I'm joined by Opsa today.
This is going to be a good one.
Oh, it's going to be good. This book continues to drop bombshells on us, chapter after chapter after chapter, and today is no different.
2/3 of the way in, and still getting revelations, you know, and still a bunch of cliffhangers and open questions, even so.
Totally, totally. Well, before we dive into today's reading, let's knock out a quick bit of housekeeping, starting with a spoiler warning. As the title implies, we are diving into the Three Body Problem, chapters 21 through 26 today. So before you continue listening, please make sure that you've done the reading.
And as always, we encourage you to read along with us and share your thoughts. Email us at scifibookclubpod@loreparty.com. Join the Patreon. Got a bunch of members in there. It's really exciting to see. And that's at patreon.com/scifibookclubpod. We post free reading guides, discussion questions, bonus clips, bloopers, all the good stuff right there on that Patreon. And you'll also find our Discord, where we've got so many members all joining in with their comments and thoughts, and love to see it. So please join us. And you'll, of course, find all those links in the show notes. So no need to remember that. But join us.
That's right. Okay, so here's the game plan for today's episode. By now, if you have been reading along with us, you know what's in store. We will begin by summarizing the chapters from today's reading. Then we'll each share our first impressions and predictions of what may be to come. And finally, we will be diving deep into our sci-fi analysis and exploring some takeaways. And something new we're doing today is this is a book club after all, so we decided we want to regularly be sharing comments and observations and questions from listeners like you, from the folks in our Discord and in our Patreon communities. So stick around until the end of the episode. We have a couple of really great comments to share from our community. Now, before we get into all of that, let's take a quick break. Let's gear up for today's reading, but don't go anywhere, dear listener, because when we come back, we are getting into those chapter summaries.
All right, welcome back, and we'll be jumping right into our summary. So we are going through chapters 21 to 26, and at the outset here, we see Wong attending a big meeting of the ETO where Ponhan boldly declares that he did, in fact, kill Shen Yufei.
My goodness.
I'm sure. Shocking for all.
Yeah.
And it's clear there's division among this group, as it seems Pon was working under the orders of a splinter group called the Adventists, led by this mysterious shadow figure named Evans. Mike Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And the bombshells keep dropping as the commander-in-chief
of
the ETO finally enters.
Who can it be?
And lo and behold, it's none other than
the Undertaker!
Yes, and truly one of the best moments of the book so far. The Undertaker is resurrected by Liu Cixin as the head of the ETO. Just God. Phenomenal writing. Truly phenomenal. The crossover we never knew we needed. But
huge
here it is.
WWE fan. Please, yes. Yes.
From across the river. Yeah. So it's, in fact, Yewen Xie, which wow. just as shocking, I will yes. say. And she comes in, immediately confronts Pan, who is demanding that she make her true allegiance known. Is she an Adventist or Redemptionist? As it turns out, the Adventists want the Trisolarans to wipe out humanity Yikes. As divine punishment. And Ye claims that Evans and his splinter group need to be eliminated in okay. order to protect the broader ideals of the ETO.
Yeah.
So in what seems like mere seconds, one of Ye's bodyguards snaps Pan Han's neck.
Oh, my God.
And then yeah, just casually turns to Wong and begins retelling her tale at Red Coast Base.
Wow. What a chapter. I was enthralled.
Yeah, this was a good one.
It was a good one. All right, chapter 22, we flash back to Red Coast Base. And my God, after just like pages and pages of science jargon about the sun and radio waves, we ultimately come to the crux of it. The discovery that the sun can be used as a radio wave amplifier. This is huge.
Yeah.
But alas, we are still in Mao Zedong's China, and politically speaking, shooting a giant antenna at the sun, at the rising sun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't the most politically savvy thing to be doing at this time?
You don't say.
And Commissar Lei basically is like, don't do this. It's going to destroy our careers and our lives. So no, you're not allowed to test your sun radio wave amplifier theory.
All right.
Yewen Xie, being Yewen Xie, does exactly that. She does it anyway, just in secret. She shoots radio waves at the sun to test it. She rushes into Chief Yang's office and asks him to monitor for any echoes bouncing back from the sun. Much to his shock and anger, he's like, you did the thing we weren't supposed to do.
The one thing.
You're already so politically suspect and you're out yeah. here shooting the sun. Hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, she's already persona non grata. This is not okay. You can't be doing this. She shouldn't be on the base, you know.
Truly not okay. But she does it anyway. And unfortunately for everyone, no signal is picked up. There are no echoes.
Right.
And what kind of adds salt to the wound in this very moment as well is that this American astronomer whose data that Yewen Xie had been sort of working alongside doesn't match up with her theories or with her data. So everything falls apart here. No echo from the sun, and the American astronomer's data doesn't line up. So basically, Yewen Xie gives up. And a distraught Ye basically walks off to the cafeteria, eats a really sad lunch alone. But in the final words of this chapter, we, the reader, are told the truth. Quote, Ye didn't know that at that moment, the first cry that could be heard in space from civilization on Earth was already spreading out from the sun to the universe at the speed of light. End Oof. Quote.
Oh, yes.
Wow. Her theory was correct.
Yes. Yeah, I think in this section, we come to understand that we're basically able to be a Kardashev type 2 civilization. We can harness the power of the sun, you know.
Incredible. Which is,
so kudos, yeah, for defying everyone, defying the odds, and making this totally non-political statement, but huge political mistake, and yes. then firing yes. the laser at the sun.
Yeah, a great chapter.
So in chapter 23, we jump 8 years forward, and we're still in the era during the Cultural Revolution. It's more or less faded, and at this point, yeah, marries Chief Yang. It's not out of love. It's purely a gratitude relationship, which seems to be a recurring theme in this book. But in any case, they do, in fact, get married, and despite the changing political atmosphere, Ye continues to be haunted by her trauma and her belief that humanity's capacity for evil is only at its height, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she falls into a spiritual crisis, you know, deep depression, and is just ruminating when a miracle occurs. A signal from extraterrestrial intelligence responds to her.
My palms were sweating reading this chapter.
This was the one. The first contact. And the message is, do not answer.
Oh.
And it's repeated three times. Do not answer. Do not answer. Do not answer.
Right. Three exclamation points. So you know it's serious.
It's only increasing. And in perhaps the greatest betrayal against the human race, yeah answers.
No, no!
Despite this warning, she invites them to Earth and promises to help them conquer humanity.
Oh my gosh.
Which, okay, yeah. And yet another revelation at the end of this chapter.
Okay.
After sending her message, she faints, and we find out she's pregnant.
Oh my God. Okay, the next one's pretty short. Chapter 24 is very action-packed. We jump back into the present day. The ETO meeting is suddenly attacked by a bunch of police and soldiers led by Da Shi.
Oh yeah.
There's this very tense standoff with nuclear weapons. But thanks to some very quick thinking by Da Shi, the damage of the nuclear weapon is minimized and Yuwencia is arrested alongside almost all of the ETO members in attendance. And it seems like a win for the police forces and the battle station that has seemingly been working against the ETO in secret this whole time.
Right. Well, moving on to chapter 25, we witness Yuwencia now in an interrogation and... Mm-hmm. During this interrogation, yet another massive bombshell drops.
My heart.
This time about her time at Red Coast Base, where we find that Commissar Lei was basically trying to blackmail Yeah into keeping quiet about the alien transmission, which he had found out about.
Right.
He had some super secret logging software on their machines and saw the message that came in. But rather than simply reprimand her, he's trying to take credit for it, quite clearly, like transparently trying to take credit for it. and unfortunately for him, Yaz not going to take that laying down.
Hello.
She comes up with a way to, in fact, murder him.
Wow.
So her, unfortunately, at this point, somewhat clueless husband kind of stumbles in and is trying to help Commissar Lei as he's like repairing some equipment that... Yeah, had sabotaged, and unfortunately, in kind of a split-second decision, she kills them both.
Rather than
let Commissar Lei live and get away, she sacrifices her husband in order to get rid of Commissar Lei.
Right, for the cause, which we'll talk a bit about in our takeaway later.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap up today's summary. Our final chapter, chapter 26, recounts... Ye's last few years at Red Coast Base.
Right.
At this time, she begins to tutor students from a nearby village. It's very cute. They come to her for lessons because they're studying for their college entrance exams that have now reopened because the political turmoil in the country is beginning to subside.
Right.
Ye also gives birth to her daughter, Yang Dong, at this time. It's a very harrowing experience for her. She nearly dies in the process, and it's only thanks to the villagers donating blood to her that she survives the whole ordeal.
Really touching.
Very touching. She's then taken in by said villagers because the base can't accommodate a single mother and a newborn child, so she goes and lives with them for 6 months, and they support Ye and her daughter. And it's during this period of her life that Yuwencia witnesses the kind of unconditional kindness and love that humans are capable of that I imagine she probably hasn't experienced since she herself was a child.
Right.
Now, these months for her are described as very sort of surreal and idyllic for Ye. She almost remembers this time as belonging to someone else's life.
Right.
Now, Yeh does eventually leave both the village and Red Coast base. She is politically rehabilitated. She gets some back pay that her dad was owed from the college, which I was like, okay, good for the college, damn.
Yeah, kind of an odd note to throw in there, but all right, I'll take it.
I'll take it. She accepts a job at Tsinghua University. I completely butchered that. I'm so sorry. And she returns to the city and reconnects with her truly awful mother. Like, her mother is this, like, snake who's been using the political turmoil to basically find herself a sugar daddy and live a very comfortable life. She's right. An opportunist in almost every way, which we saw at the very start of the book, too.
Yes.
Yeh, also, once she returns to the city, manages to find and reconnect with three of the four young girls who are responsible for killing her father.
All right.
And Yeh tries to sort of connect with them on a human level. What she's really kind of looking for is any sense that they repent for what they've done, that they feel sorry, that they want to apologize to her in any way for killing her father. None of that. They're stone cold. And in fact, they're completely self-absorbed and show no empathy or sympathy beyond their own pitiful circumstances, right? They're like, well, I lost an arm because of this bullshit, so I don't know what you're crying about.
Yeah. Who's going to cry
for
me?
You only lost your dad. Yeah, right. Who's going to cry for me?
Right.
And, you know, on some level, you're like, okay, I get it. You lost an arm. That's awful. You clearly had a shitty life. But Yeh also is like, you are responsible for killing my father, and yet you have no empathy for me. And this chapter basically ends on a pretty dark note where Yeh's belief in the evil nature of humanity, this thing that she's pondered on so much in isolation at Red Coast Base, is reconfirmed here.
Right.
And this basically solidifies her desire and her commitment to help the Trisolarans get to Earth and take over humanity, because she believes humanity can no longer save itself.
Yeah.
And that's the dark note that we end chapter 26 on and today's reading. What did you think, Obsim?
Yeah, actually, I found myself, and in particular in response to her confrontation with these now older ladies, I found that there was a passage in particular that kind of humanized them for me, more than it seems that it did for Yeh. And it goes like this, and this is the one-armed woman speaking, and she says, quote, "There was a movie called Maple recently. I don't know if you've seen it. At the end, an adult and a child stand in front of the grave of a Red Guard who had died during the faction civil wars. The child asks the adult, are they heroes? The adult says no. The child asks, are they enemies? The adult again says no. The child asks, then who are they? The adult says, history. And that to me, I will say, like, it does put into broader perspective the truth that there really were no winners. There were no...
Yeah.
They were all victims. They felt the brutality of the time, and they certainly got swept up in the emotion of it and in the kind of zeal and ardor for their country and this, like, change and movement. And there is something about that made them a little bit more forgivable to me and didn't necessarily draw the need for kind of repentance or even regret in their past actions. But of course, when Sia witnessed them murder her father in broad daylight in public and to the, you know, imagined cheers, essentially, of the crowd that was arranged before them. So
right.
I think that's the thing that I was left with, obviously, with that being the final passage in this section. But all in all, I mean, just blockbuster section. I mean, we got, you know, some really, really exciting developments. When Sia, ETO commander revelation.
My God.
I mean, I don't know about for you, but it was incredible. I don't know. I feel like, honestly, that we probably could have predicted it, but I was completely shocked, just as much as Wang Miao or probably any of our fellow listeners here when Sia walked in the room.
Yeah. I was shocked. I mean, I think the book does this really smart thing where Yewensia disappears from the story for many, many chapters, and we spend a lot of time in the VR game and with Dashi and the murder of Shen Yufei, and there's enough sort of distraction that by the time Yewensia comes back into this story in the bombshell reveal that she is the commander-in-chief, it genuinely caught me off guard.
Right.
So I think it was very smartly done. There was enough time between the last time we interacted with her to the bombshell reveal that it landed for me, at least.
Yeah. Less shocking, and in fact, probably surprising absolutely no one, was the news that Shen Yufei was indeed killed by Pan Han, who is as treacherous a motherfucker as you can find in all the universe. So, yeah, him turning out to not only be a murderer, but also just this industry plant in the eco movement.
Hilarious.
Totally checked out. I mean, just totally hilarious. Checked out. Yeah, truly. I don't know. You'd love to hate somebody, and what he says at the outset makes him just cartoonishly villainous.
Oh
and,
my
and
goodness!
Just such an obvious fool.
I love this quote.
Yeah. Do you think I became famous for myself? To my eyes, the entire human race is a pile of garbage.
No.
Why would I care what they think? But if I'm not famous, how do I direct and channel their thinking?
Incredible.
It's incredible. Just like Bond villain level. Like, let me tell you that I'm a villain by telling you that I'm a villain.
Yeah.
Sort of, exposition here, but really quite hilarious.
So funny.
Yeah.
Full on Bond villain. That's a great way to put it. He's like a bad Bond villain.
Bad one. Pond truly on a bad here. One. But I don't know. What did you think? What was this section like for you?
I felt very similarly to you. This section I thought was full of some great revelations, some amazing twists and turns, very enjoyable reading it throughout. I certainly liked it more than last episode's section, where I felt we got way too bogged down in some boring stuff and some sci-fi jargon. We certainly got bogged down in science jargon here for a little bit with the sun stuff, but then it all led up to a very cool conclusion. So this time around, I can be a bit more forgiving about it. Like we said, the Yewensia as the founder revelation is like truly a mic drop moment. I think it's done perfectly in the structure of the book. I also, in general, my takeaway later will be about this, but in general, I just love how fleshed out of a character Yewensia is, right? We truly get to see her emotional journey through this book, and she plays a pivotal role in the plot. Like, she is what this book is about primarily.
Yeah.
And I liked that we got the depth that we did of her, both internal and external struggles. I also wanted to very briefly commend Liu Xixin for the writing in chapter 26 in particular. Her time in the village is described so beautifully, and the writing very smartly goes from this scientific, logical, rational Yewensia thought process to being very poetic, right? We're describing these European oil paintings, and it becomes very metaphorical rather than literal or scientific, which much of this book is. So really great writing in that section. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's clear he has more than one paintbrush and he knows when to wield them. Mm-hmm. You do sometimes wish that he would flesh out the other characters a little more. But...
yes. And that's primarily my issue. Like, if I had to nitpick some things in these chapters, my issue is very similar to what I had last time in the previous episode or two. There's just a lot of science jargon, and the ideas once again take center stage, and the characters start to feel like hollow shells who are there just to deliver the ideas. Right. This is certainly a weaknesses of Liu Xixin's in his writing. And in particular, there's one guy who hilariously raises his hand and gives his own backstory about Palestine and Israel and how he was disenchanted with humanity and then joined the ETO and got radicalized. And all of that in a single paragraph, just so he can say like one quick thing of exposition about the Adventists. I'm like, bro, what's happening? Why did we need this paragraph? And who is this guy? He's not even named.
Yeah, he's unnamed. Unnamed Israeli Palestinian banker. It's hard to know, but...
Like, that's where I start to cringe a little bit, because I think we start to see Xixin's weakness when it comes to figuring out how to get characters to deliver dialogue that explains the exposition in a way that isn't clunky. Very clunky here.
Yeah.
I also, in general, found the chapter with the showdown with the nuclear bombs and the Dashi thing, and the action scene didn't feel natural to me. It felt very forced. A lot of the logic of the scene didn't seem to make sense.
Right.
I actually, for folks who have watched the Netflix adaptation, I actually think the Netflix show handled this attack scene by Dashi and the army much better. And the rationalization for how the ETO members acted in the scene make much more sense in the Netflix show than they do in the book.
Yeah.
So some minor criticisms here when it comes to writing with the characters and the motivations of, in particular, the ETO members and why they're doing what they're doing. It's a little paper thin just because it's clear that Shishin is much more interested in the big ideas with the science and the aliens and the all of the big stuff.
Yeah. He very clearly speeds through the sections that I think he personally is just not interested in.
Totally, so, totally. This is one of the shortest chapters in the book. Yes, he's like, I don't give a fuck about some action scene. I just got to get to the next plot point.
Yeah, yeah. Same with the romances. There are none in this,
totally
this entire
off page,
novel.
Right.
Yeah, no. And
how did Chief Yang propose to Ye Wenxia? This I must know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I probably wrote it on a note. And was
it
like,
romantic? Right. Was it like in Morse code? Did he do some cute thing on the like satellite dish computer where he was just like, beep, 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 beep.
Yes, exactly.
Will you marry me?
Between that and the fact that there are theoretically three nuclear bombs in this section. Like, I was like, okay, let's see. And then it just kind of fizzles out and it's a little lame. But you know, it's I think we've definitely underscored that Liu Cixin has his interests and his motivations, and they're not really revolving around the characters or the action elements of the story.
Definitely. Still a great set of chapters though, and I'm excited to finish this book. This is our penultimate episode. We only have one more episode and one more set of chapters to go, and I truly can't wait to see where we go next, what the conclusion is.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, that wraps up our chapter summaries and some of our impressions and perhaps predictions of what's to come. Let's take another quick breather, but don't go anywhere, dear listener, because when we come back, we have a couple of takeaways to get through and a lot to say about Ye Wenxia. So we'll see you in a minute.
All right, and we are back, and we'll be talking about some of the takeaways we have from this section. I know, Abu, you've got a lot to say about Ye Wenxia and her narrative arc, so please jump right in.
I do have a lot to say about Ye Wenxia, and in particular, I want to explore her emotional journey across these chapters, but also generally across the book thus far.
Yeah.
And what I want us to keep in mind as I go through my takeaway here, is this question. Does Ye Wenxia feel any remorse for what she has done? Because I think at first glance, and certainly on my first read of the book all those years ago, I just assumed no. Ye Wenxia feels no remorse, and she simply hates all of humanity. She's gone through some traumatic events and has no hope for humanity and doesn't care. Wants aliens to come and do their alien thing.
Yeah.
So I want to dig a little bit deeper into a few quotes that I pulled that I think make it fairly clear, at least to me, that Ye's feeling about her betrayal of humanity is more complex than just she hates humanity and doesn't feel remorse. So to start, let's consider the actual moment itself.
Yeah.
The iconic moment that Ye Wenxia single-handedly dooms the entire human race. Quote, the transmit button was a long rectangle, very similar to the space key on a computer keyboard, except that it was red. Ye's hand hovered 2 centimeters above it. The fate of the entire human race was now tied to these slender fingers. Without hesitation, Ye pressed the button. End quote. A truly iconic moment.
Yes.
And on a reread, this moment almost starts to feel a bit mythical to me. I don't know if you got that
absolutely.
Sense.
Yeah, certainly. Right? Big red button. Come on.
Big red button. Yeah. Fingers hovering. No hesitation. Like,
yes.
It feels like we're crafting a bit of a story here. And that line of thinking led me to the realization that these flashback chapters in today's reading are when Sia recounting her story for the gathered ETO members, right?
Right.
So perhaps we're dealing with a bit of an unreliable narrator who's softening some of the edges of the history, right? How she made first contact.
All right.
And I personally kind of have a hard time believing that someone as rational and as supremely intelligent as Ye Wenxia committed to this course of action with no hesitation, with no second thought.
Right.
And in particular, in the very quote that I just read, there's that line about her fingers hovering 2 centimeters above the button. To me, that line itself implies some sort of hesitation.
Right, right.
The fact that your fingers are hovering at all tells me that you're thinking about something before you hit the button.
Right.
So I'm going to call a little bit of bullshit here and maybe lean into the idea that we have an unreliable narrator that's telling more the mythology of the ETO and less the actual truth of what occurred.
Right, right. And her own rationalizations of her act here.
Exactly.
Could be self-deception as well.
Exactly. Great point. So I do want to acknowledge that this decision that she makes comes at a very dark time for Ye. She's struggling with her trauma. She's cut off from human society here at Red Coast Base. And we get this quote. Quote, as she pondered human nature, Ye was faced with an ultimate loss of purpose and sank into another spiritual crisis. As this mental state persisted, she gradually felt more and more alienated from the world. After she made a home with Yang, her soul became homeless. End quote.
Oof. Yeah.
Tough look for our guy, Chief Yang.
Yeah. He wasn't the lover that she needed.
Certainly not. Certainly not, you know? He didn't exactly give her the dick that would have saved humanity.
Okay. All right. Blame the patriarchy. I mean, you're not wrong.
I'm just saying,
you're not
if the
wrong.
Sex was better, would she have called the aliens?
Good point.
Just saying.
Yeah.
So it's a very dark time for Ye, clearly, right? She's also watching the Cold War take place and nuclear proliferation happening across the globe. And to her, based on her ideology of how she sees humanity, her natural conclusion is, oh, we're on the path to our own destruction. We're totally fucked anyway.
Right.
So the timing is very interesting to me. This Trisolaran message simply could not have arrived at a worse time for Ye Wenxia, mentally and emotionally speaking. And man, throughout this reading and on a reread, I just couldn't help but imagine what her decision would have been if this message arrived just like a year later after her time in the village.
Yeah.
After she saw what the best of humanity could offer.
Right, right.
And I wonder if she'd still respond to the aliens.
Yeah.
Now, this naturally leads me to my next quote that I want to call out. This one is from her time in the village and from her time seeing the love that humanity has to offer. Quote, in this tiny mountain hamlet deep in the greater Qing'an Mountains, something finally thawed in Ye Wenxia's heart. In the frozen tundra of her soul, a tiny clear lake of meltwater appeared. End quote.
Wow. There's some of that writing that Cixin can certainly serve up, you know?
Certainly. How poetic is that? That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it also shows us that this tough exterior that Ye has built around her heart in order to survive her trauma has been melted by some of the love and friendship and camaraderie she's experienced in the village. Clearly, her time in the village softened her view on humanity somewhat.
Yes. She's clearly not a sociopath, ultimately.
Yes.
Like, that's something that we recognize the humanity in Ye Wenxia. Like, she's a real person with emotional depth and scars that she's only apparently now coming to grapple with and have softened.
Such a great point. Such a great point. This really humanizes her. This village scene on a first read I thought was corny, but the more I read it, the more I was like, this is so necessary to humanize Ye Wenxia. Otherwise, yeah. She is just like this caricature of like a sociopath.
Yeah.
And what I found really interesting is how she's sort of pulled out of this oil, European oil painting of a time in her memory, right? Because there's that scene where Feng, the family that she's staying with, one of the mothers there, Feng, asks a question about the stars falling down.
Hmm.
Will those stars ever fall down? And it kind of makes Ye uncomfortable. And my read on it was that it shakes up this daydream that she's living in the village. It shakes her back into reality because she has to once again think about the stars as an astrophysicist. And perhaps it reminds her that she is solely responsible for humanity's destruction by an alien race. The stars won't fall, but perhaps bombs from alien ships certainly will fall on this very village.
Yes. And she also at this point has her baby child. I mean, she has an infant Yang Dong.
That's right.
Who's being nurtured by herself, but also the rest of the villagers. That is a transformative moment. Having a child is something that does fundamentally change you.
Yeah, certainly. And I think the fact that she has a kid makes her think of the future more, too, beyond just herself, because now her daughter will live in the future that she has created for humanity.
Oh, man, what a conundrum.
What a conundrum. So the last quote I want to call out here in my takeaway, just to wrap up, is in chapter 26. Her confrontations with her remorseless mother and her father's murderers freeze Ye Wenxia's heart once more. Quote, "The small sliver of hope for society that had emerged in her soul had evaporated like a drop of dew in the sun. Her tiny sense of doubt about her supreme act of betrayal had also disappeared without a trace." End quote. That is so depressing that there was a sense of doubt that her soul had softened a little bit and that maybe she did have some hope for humanity thanks to the love she experienced and the connection she had with these children she was tutoring. And then to have all of that shattered once more is brutal.
Yes.
But I want to go back to my original theory that this is Ye Wenxia telling the mythology of the ETO. And to me, I'm once again slightly skeptical that it's so clean cut, that these events, her mother and the girls who killed her father, completely made her flip 180 again, or like completely close her heart off again in such a clean cut way.
Yeah.
I like to think even modern day Ye Wenxia, decades later, maybe still has a little bit of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of very rapid-fire things I want to call out that make me think this. First of all, in this ETO meeting, when Wong brings up Yang Dong's death, her daughter's death, Ye full-on dodges the question.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally doesn't respond to it in any way.
Yeah, just like bulldozes it, moves on to the next thing.
Exactly. And that, to me, immediate red flag. That, to me, says you don't feel good about what happened there.
Yes.
And perhaps you feel responsible for it.
Right.
The other moment is when she is being interrogated and she's recounting how she murdered Lei and Yang. She hesitates. Eventually, she has to stop telling the story. And that, again, to me, is a humanizing moment for Ye Wenxia that says perhaps the decisions she's made thus far, as resolute as she has been, still haunt her somewhat deep down, very deep down.
Right.
And so, while I'm not defending Ye Wenxia's betrayal at all of humanity, I do understand her deeply pessimistic view and where it's coming from. I do think it's more nuanced than just blind hatred.
Yeah.
And I think deep down somewhere, perhaps very deep down, Ye Wenxia still harbors some doubt and perhaps even some guilt over what she's done.
Mm.
And maybe she finds herself in a position where she has crossed the Rubicon and there's just simply no turning back now.
Right, right.
And so she's got to lean in. So that's my takeaway. A bit long-winded there, but I really dove into some of these quotes and I wanted to really pick at this idea of whether Ye Wenxia feels any remorse. I posit that she does, even to this day.
Yeah. I think you make a really convincing argument there. There's a lot there that was a little bit more nuanced than I had given credit for in my initial read-through as well. But it's absolutely true. There are moments that clearly indicate that however resolute she is today, when she looks back, there are these hesitations, there are these pauses that kind of lend a lot of strength to your theory there.
What about you? So that was my takeaway. You also wanted to dig a bit deeper into Yowensia, so I'm very curious to see where you take this.
Let's keep the Wensia fest going. So, that's right. So in my case, I think I wanted to build further on Wensia, and in particular, the motif of conviction that is, for me, just so present in these chapters. Beginning with the sentence that actually follows the quote you shared earlier when Yawensia was recounting her past to the gathered ETO members and Wang Miao. Quote, her tiny sense of doubt about her supreme act of betrayal had also disappeared without a trace. Yeah, finally had her unshakable ideal to bring superior civilization from elsewhere in the universe into the human world. So I'll pair that one with another to just really drum this point in. To the question of how she felt when she murdered Commissar Lei and her husband, she answers, quote, calm. I did it without feeling anything. I had finally found a goal to which I could devote myself. I didn't care what price had to be paid, either by me or by others. I also knew that the entire human race would pay an unprecedented price for this goal. So I'm definitely convinced by the argument that in the present day, she's got some doubt, she's got some remorse as she looks back on her actions. But at the same time, whether or not she has doubts about her actions, or we can trust her telling of the story, because I agree, she's not entirely the most reliable narrator in these moments. And there's, of course, just the psychological self-defenses we have, you know, like we're not going to write ourselves as the villain of our own narrative. Yeah. So I totally agree that there's a question about her reliability here. But at the same time, every day since those choices, she's remained committed to following them through till her death or their accomplishment. True. And that to me is really, it speaks to this like notion of single-minded conviction that I want to unpack a little bit further.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we recognize as a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, there are all sorts of benefits, but harms that we've also seen throughout human history. You know, on the one hand, it's enabled the most ardent, selfless members of our species to endure hardships and tribulations in pursuit of ideals like justice and self-determination and equality. You know, these big, lofty, noble ideals that we hold. You can think of Gandhi or Nelson Mandela or more recently, you know, Russia's Alexei Navalny.
Yeah.
But that same instinct to unwavering dedication to a cause also has darker manifestations. Fanaticism and delusion and zealotry that often blind individuals and drive them to perform heinous acts. I found from our last discussion, I found it to just be really fascinating to think about what would lead me to join a cult like the Adventists, you know, or the ETO more widely, you know. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And what I think is like intriguing about these chapters is that we're now seeing it from the other side. The question is here, what would it take for someone to lead a movement, especially one as large and far-reaching as the ETO appears to be?
Yeah.
So putting yourself in Wensia's shoes, I think, is something that we're both finding ourselves doing and approaching it from these different angles. But it's also, for me, what makes the character of Pan Han somewhat forgivable. <You know? laughs> as thin of a character as he is, and as quickly as he was killed off, and like rightfully so.
Right. Even his monocle and cane, you're ready to forgive.
That's all right. Well, his fashion choices are truly heinous.
The most villainous part of himself is those pants.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. So, I mean, you know, he is truly villainous. And in revealing his kind of egotistical nature, his motives are put on clear display. And they obviously have nothing to do with passion for sustainability or environmentalism.
Oh, really?
And it's funny because even his like comrades are like, you're not even doing a good job of being an eco-terrorist. Like, they're fully like coming at him, and he like tries to like, you know, pass it off, but fortunately he's, you know, he's killed off quickly, so we don't have to linger too much on it. But in many ways, he does kind of represent this like traditional leader archetype that we typically mock, you know, drawn to power, but kind of wholly lacking in courage or conviction.
He's
clearly no Yaz Atai. He certainly wouldn't have stood his ground in the face of the political pressure and personal danger during the Cultural Revolution.
Oh, definitely not.
He's clearly kind of a coward. You know?
Like, I mean, he's Ye Wenxia's mom, right? He's an opportunist.
Right.
He will do whatever it takes. He'll worm his way through whatever, betray whoever he needs to.
Exactly.
To get to an end goal, which is the end goal is always himself, propping himself up.
Exactly. It's what makes him the perfect foil for Ye Wenxia. You know, despite the revelations about her own treachery, which, to be fair, are on a massive scale. You know, she's betrayed all of humanity, to these potentially hostile forces. She's also, we've witnessed, you know, murdered her husband. But despite all of this, there's still a genuine and resolute purpose in her actions that, given the full context of her life, I hesitate to say, but you can kind of rationalize. You can kind of see that there's a certain logic to it. She's not responding out of a, as we've said, you know, it's kind of a sociopathic lack of empathy for the rest of humanity. It's from a sense that we are failing ourselves, that we will bring our own destruction, and possibly there's something out there that will do a better job of remedying the situation than we've kind of thus far done ourselves.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't know. As you were talking about Wenxia's turmoil and development in your takeaway, I couldn't help but empathize with this woman who, you know, over the course of this book, we've witnessed suffer horribly, you know, like things that most of us have never feared. And though we, of course, can't excuse her actions, it's not quite so easy to write her off as Pan Han. Her villainy seems somehow more noble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think her story is quite done yet. And I think the question that we're left with is, can the leader of the Redemptionists redeem herself?
Yeah. Ooh. Beautifully put, Osa. Because you're absolutely right. It is hard to completely write her off. And I think that speaks to how fleshed out she is, how three-dimensional of a character she is. We've followed her journey from the very opening lines of this book onward. And yeah, it's easy to understand how she got here, but it's certainly not easy to say that she should have done what she should have done, or that we would have done any different. Would we have joined the ETO? Do they have good 401ks? I don't know. You know, like, what would get me to join a cult like that?
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. Really great takeaway there. And I also am now left wondering if there is a redemption arc in store for her in the future, in these final few chapters in this book.
Yep.
We'll have to find out. All right, that wraps up our takeaways for today's episode. As promised, we want to share some listener thoughts here at the end of the episode before we say goodbye. As we always say, this is a book club, and this show does not work without you, dear listener, participating, sharing your thoughts with us and the rest of our community, both in Discord and on Patreon. So we got a couple of really great messages, and we've had some really fun discussions with y'all these past few weeks reading the book, and there are a couple that we wanted to share in particular.
Let's start with this really fun fact about Alpha Centauri from none other than Juice Boy.
Icon.
For a long time, everyone thought that Alpha Centauri only had two stars orbiting each other. But when they observed their orbits around each other, they found out that it was more chaotic and unpredictable than it should have been. And they soon discovered a third, dimmer star that was also gravitationally influencing the other two. There have also been planets discovered orbiting the stars in the Alpha Centauri system. So just pretty interesting. So it's in fact a three-body system, and all the more remarkable for being really quite in line with the tale in this story. I mean, Alpha Centauri appears to be where the Trisolarans are coming from, and you know, kudos to Cetian for, I don't know the timeline here, but very plausible novel written with some insightful understanding of our universe.
Totally amazing stuff. I certainly didn't know that about Alpha Centauri, so I appreciated Juice Boy in our Discord sharing that science fact.
Yeah,
that there is in fact a three body problem happening right next door to us.
Yeah, speaking on
a galactic scale, just four tiny, tiny light years away. All right, another quick message from Discord that we want to share. This one is from Josh Link, and Josh was sharing a bit of a pessimistic view about alien intelligence and possible first contact. Josh wrote, quote, "I think a Type 3 civilization would be inherently predatory. If your civilization is so advanced that it can harness the power of an entire galaxy, then consuming more primitive civilizations would happen practically by accident. A civilization like that would probably treat us the way we treat algae." Mm. End quote.
Yeah. Well, Josh, hard to disagree there. I mean,
hard to disagree.
Yeah. A Type 3 civilization, if I recall, is a civilization that can harness the power of a galaxy, and that, I can't imagine how you could do that without crushing some other
completely
beings, you know?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, our discussions in this read through of the book have truly affected the way I think day to day.
Yeah.
The other day there was a fly that flew into our apartment and I was trying to get it out, and I was kind of like, I'm like a Type 2 civilization to this fly. Yeah. And I'm just going to crush it because it's a minor minor nuisance to me.
Right, right.
But I have no idea what's going on in this fly's day.
Yeah.
Or in this None fly's life. Does he have family back home?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I mean, this is the power of science fiction and the power of storytelling like this, right? Yes. Like, it has changed the way I look at the world and how I consider our place in the universe, but also our responsibility in the universe. What is my responsibility to that fly? What about that ant that I unintentionally and accidentally crushed in my backyard as I stepped on it?
Right.
To Josh's point here in Discord, that is potentially what a Type 3 civilization would do to us. Just accidentally crush us on the way to something way bigger and more important.
Right. Right. Yeah, it is a scary thought. <you know? laughs> Yeah. I mean, obviously, all of our history has been kind of putting humans on this pedestal. We are at the center of the universe. Like, we thought the sun revolved around us. And,
right.
And the truth is, we're kind of an insignificant speck in the grand, on the grand scale of the universe.
Yeah. Maybe that's what gets us to join the ETO. Yeah. That's a good sales pitch.
Well, the truth is, I've already joined.
Hello.
There's also one additional thing I'll share, not a thought, but some poll results for our last poll on Spotify, in fact, to the question of, do you have hope for humanity?
Okay.
Our audience was split. So
okay. All right.
Half of us out there still got V's up, still believe in humanity.
Amazing.
And,
amazing.
And the other half has fallen down the pessimistic road and are ready to join the ETO.
Amazing. Optimistic gang, rise up, join me.
That's right.
We're going to make it through. I'm certainly falling on that side of the equation. Thank you, as always, for participating in those polls on Spotify. And thank you to Josh, Juice Boy, and everyone else who's in the Discord, who's on Patreon, who is leaving comments and interacting with us, but also with everyone else in our community. Again, that is the heart and soul of this show. All of you, all of us, interacting and sharing our experiences with these books together.
That's right.
All right. Last bit of homework for Three Body Problem. Y'all knew this was coming. Finish the book.
Complete
it. Before the next episode, get to the end, get to the final chapter of this book. Make sure you've read it in its entirety for our next and final episode about the three-body problem before we move on to our next book. And as always, if you're curious what the next book will be or the book after that and what the rest of the season looks like, our entire seasonal reading schedule is always linked in the show notes, so you can always go check it. We keep it up to date with release dates and chapters, so you will always know what the reading assignments are and when you gotta get them done by.
That's right. All right, friends, that is our episode, and we want you to know, Sci-Fi Book Club Pod is no longer capable of solving its own problems. We need your help. So leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and be sure to check the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com.
You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at lore_party. Thank you so much for listening, and remember to do your part to bring superior podcasting from the human world into the universe.